This is a movie dork podcast that likes to contextualize its subjects through the time and place that created them. So we often touch upon seismic, game-changing moments in film history, the creation of the Hollywood studio system in the 1910s and 20s, unionization efforts among filmmakers in the 30s and 40s, the anti-communist witch hunts that directly followed that unionization effort in the 50s, the collapse of the Hollywood studio system in the 60s, the new Hollywood era in the following decade, all of the major studios getting gobbled up by faceless corporate oligarchies in the years leading up to Reaganomics taking over. All of those things had dramatic effects on what kinds of movies got made and how they were made. The advent of home video was just as big a game changer as anything else I mentioned, if not more so. Watching an entire movie through a device hooked up to your TV in the comfort of your own home dates back to the 1970s on a technological level, but it began gaining traction in the following decade. Laserdisc and Betamax jostled for prominence in the developing field, but the much inferior VHS format ultimately won out, largely because it was cost-effective for pornography. Hollywood was reticent about home video. Re-releasing old movies was seen as a valuable source of passive revenue that home video threatened. Hollywood hated, and still kinda does hate, the idea that you could buy a copy of a movie once and then watch it over and over again without paying them additional money. For most of the 80s, videos of prominent Hollywood blockbusters were made prohibitively expensive if they were released at all in order to dissuade anyone except for utterly diehard fans from buying them. On our Chopping Mall episode, we discussed how this opened up a market for low-budget grindhouse studios. Video rental stores were desperate for content and were willing to put anything on their shelves as long as it was salacious enough. This type of filler content is essentially the forebear of the chum one finds on Netflix and Amazon Prime today.
Yay!
Hollywood changed its tune when Top Gun, the highest-grossing film of 1986, was released on VHS for the relatively low price of $26.95. It sold almost 3 million copies, convincing studio execs that home video was actually an ally and not an enemy. This leads us to Tiny Toons, How I Spent My Summer Vacation, the first original animated film released direct-to-video. My childhood was littered with scores of direct-to-video cartoon fare, so this was clearly a profitable idiom for the entertainment industry. Still, somebody had to be the first person to figure out that producing an animated film and marketing it to bored Kmart shoppers on impulse was an underexploited market. In retrospect, it shouldn't be surprising that Steven Spielberg was the initial person to jump in on this.
Oh, absolutely.
My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. All right, joining me for this one is my sister Cheryl.
Hi, I interrupted.
Well, not as much as Rachel usually does. And my brother Sylvan.
I am also here.
All right, so I recently rewatched How I Spent My Vacation. I always think of it as How I Spent My Summer Vacation, but it's apparently How I Spent My Vacation recently. But I think it's been a while for both of you.
Yeah, this is probably my first time watching it since the 90s.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, definitely since before Toby, but no, I think the 90s is probably right.
Yeah. Toby still does not like that we measure time by him.
Like two Tobys ago, I think.
Alright, so what are your hot takes? Has it held up in your estimation?
It's actually better than I thought it would be.
Oh yeah, no, like, one, I actually really enjoyed watching it, and two, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, you were really impressed by this 180-degree pan, because that's a pain in the ass to do in traditional cel animation, but they went through the trouble.
Like, I genuinely was like, that was before they had computers helping them do that, right?
Yeah, it was.
Oh my god.
Yeah, they sunk a lot into this.
But why?
There's also a lot of references that I didn't understand as a child that I understand now. It's very clever writing.
And, like, reading really, it helps. Like, it changes some of the jokes.
Yeah, Babs Bunny does an impression of Loretta Lynn. I get that now.
Yep.
If there's a gag related to Esperanto.
there were a lot of jokes that actually weren't for us, even though we were the target audience.
Well, a lot of it was for the parents, and a lot of it was the animators just making themselves laugh. Okay, anyways, plot for this. It opens with the Tiny Toons cast excitedly preparing for summer vacation after their term at Acme University ends. We open with Babs and Buster Bunny having a water pistol fight, which eventually escalates into flooding the entire community. The bunnies, along with Byron Bassett, Elmira's dog, float from the flooded Acme Acres community, which presumably thousands of people died after Babs unleashed the dam.
I'm sure they were fine.
I love that dog. Like, I forgot how much I loved that dog. Carry on. But yeah, love that dog.
Also, Buster triggers a volcanic explosion, which creates a tidal wave.
There are a lot of untold victims to their shenanigans.
And according to the map, they're in California somewhere, but this immediately sends them to the south. But, like, the southern United States that exists in A Streetcar Named Desire and other 1950s Hollywood movies that take place in that area. And for most of the rest of the feature, Buster rejects Babs' romantic advances, soaks him with the water pistol, and they encounter a succession of swamp monsters that want to eat them, culminating in all of them trying to devour Buster and Babs at once on a riverboat while they're performing a show. Although I would say the highlight of this plot is Buster getting captured by a Blanche DuBois family of alligators that plan to marry and then consume him, and then Drag King Babs Bunny rescues him as the fireworks display.
Yeah, that is probably the highlight of all of this.
That bigamy joke, like, I didn't get it when I was a kid, and I still thought it was hilarious, because I'm like, well, the inflection, clearly, it's really serious. And then I got older.
I remember asking an adult for clarification and then being uncomfortable and sidestepping answering. It was probably Dad that we asked.
Yeah, Dad had a habit of pretending to not understand jokes he didn't want to explain to us. A lot of that for The Simpsons.
That's still a good joke, though. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that one thing about this movie, and it's still there.
I mean, I'm guessing Babs did a lot of inverted Bugs Bunny Drag King bits, but that's the only one that sticks in my memory.
As a kid, I remember her dressing up a lot as, like, female actresses and either looking goofy or looking like Jessica Rabbit.
I didn't like the media impressions when I was a kid, but they didn't bother me as much now.
I still don't like them now, and I get them now.
Our most vivid plot, and the one that most people take away from this film, is the one involving Plucky Duck joining Hampton J. Pig and Hampton's family as they drive to the amusement park Happy World Land. The trip turns out to be interminably long, at least for Plucky, who becomes annoyed with the family's habits and culminates in him almost getting murdered when they pick up a hitchhiker who turns out to be an escaped convict who is driven homicidal at the sight of pigs.
So, like, Sylvan and I just, like, both admitted while we were watching this, like, and I feel like it's such a little kid thing, too, though, that we genuinely thought that he was Casey Jones from the Ninja Turtles.
He wore the hockey mask, and I thought that was a reference to Casey Jones and not Jason.
Yeah, he had long, dark hair.
I mean, I knew that they were doing, like, a Jason Voorhees bit as a kid, but he looked way more like Casey Jones. I get it. I think this one also has the best sight gags of them in terms of classic Bob Clampett, Tex Avery, Looney Tunes, eyes popping out, Plucky's tongue growing flowers, and then him mowing his tongue with a little tiny lawnmower.
All of the bits with Uncle Stinky being gross and then Plucky having, like, the tongue joke reactions to it when his tongue, like, shrivels and falls apart.
When he turns checkered, I loved that. Just also, though, this plotline was always the most relatable for me as a kid because, like, doing sleepovers or going on family trips with other people's families was always so weird.
Yeah, this is easily the most relatable segment, and
I don't know, I think Buster constantly harassing Babs and never getting punished by the adults was super relatable.
Yeah, the part where Babs' mom is like, you don't shoot Babs with that water pistol, that's an outside game. Yeah, that's our parents.
Yeah, how about that?
Yes, I was very enabled. In case you couldn't tell from the verbal context, Sylvan was referring to me carrying on. Upon arrival at Happy World Land, the family rides the Tooth monorail along the park and watches all the other families get grounded to pace by the amazing other rides that Plucky just can't wait to go on. And then they immediately head home, much to Plucky's dismay. Plucky has a bad turn in this. Nothing goes his way, and it usually doesn't because he's the Daffy Duck, but still. Meanwhile, Elmira Duff, upset upon losing her cat Furball, he finally got away, visits a safari park with her family, where she terrorizes the wild animals with her very particular brand of loving adoration. While this is going on, Fifi LaFoom, love-struck by teen heartthrob Johnny Pugh, becomes his put-upon assistant, unaware that he is uninterested in her romance. romantically and is just sort of stringing her along as help. Foulmouth and Shirley the Loon. Foulmouth eventually berates Shirley the Loon into seeing Skunknophobia, an Arachnophobia parody, although there's some like Bernard Herrmann psycho music in the soundtrack for that bit. But anyways, Fifi and Johnny end up in the same movie theater where we get the still hilarious THX sound test parody.
The audience is now deaf.
Yeah, that killed when I was 7, and it still works.
Yep.
Foulmouth disrupts the film throughout because originally he was a Foghorn Leghorn parody whose bit was that he swore constantly, but at this point he has learned to tamp it down and replace it with Dad Gum, but he's still an annoying little shithead.
He looks like the Chicken Hawk, too.
Not really. He very much looks like a miniature Foghorn Leghorn.
He's got a similar head shape, I get it. Anyways, Foulmouth disrupts throughout and is thrown out of the theater. Fifi, enraged when Johnny takes the picture that she wants him to sign and gives it to a different skunk, physically ejects Johnny from the theater, causing him to end up with Elmira and mistakenly becomes her kitty.
Like, also, by the way, I do, like, pet my cats, like, a lot, even when they do not want to be pet necessarily.
Elmira's very relatable, yes.
Yeah. It's just, I'm like, but sometimes you do need to give them kisses. Sometimes it has to happen.
After Buster and Babs escape the dinner theater on the showboat with Byron's help, they are rescued by a possum named Banjo, who Buster had befriended over the course of their journey. The escaped maniac from Plucky's car returns and attempts to kill them. He also wants to kill bunnies in addition to pigs and ducks.
He's just very carnivorous.
He's very happy.
Buster, Babs, Byron, and Banjo. Buster, Babs, Byron, and Banjo try to escape using a minecart. Sylvan pointed out that they thought that minecart chases would be an issue in our adult life.
I just thought it would come up more. I mean, between this, DuckTales, and then at Canopy Lake Park, there was a haunted minecart ride. So it just seemed like minecarts should be around more. Not as much as, like, quicksand or being set on fire, but still somewhere.
I mean, most people would immediately reference Donkey Kong Country or Temple of Doom, but we didn't really get into that as kids.
I liked Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah, but we had a Genesis.
Yeah. Friends' houses, though.
Anyways, the minecart falls off a cliff, and the quartet fall down a plot hole, which is probably the first time I encountered that storytelling idiom in any form.
I do remember asking clarifying questions about that and not being able to generate a satisfying answer from anyone.
Dad probably just didn't know. This leads them through Wacky Land and back to Acme Acres. The characters then find out that summer is over and they return to Luniversity for the fall semester, singing a little song about it to the tune of the show's theme song. Alright, a number of things had to fall in place before Tiny Toons could happen. The first thing was Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yay!
A film noir parody that served as both a social satire and a loving tribute to the golden age of animation, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was the second highest grossing film of 1988. Among other things, it made a bunch of Hollywood executives suddenly realize that old cartoon characters like Bugs Bunny, Betty Boop, and Donald Duck were widely beloved by generations of people around the world. Warner Brothers in particular seems to constantly forget that the Looney Tunes are popular, by the way. Another factor was Disney's decision to invest more heavily into syndicated TV animation. This lane was typically occupied by low-rent pap churned out by Ruby Spears, Filmation, and Hanna-Barbera, but Disney sank more money than usual into The Adventures of the Gummy Bears in 1985 and DuckTales in 1987. Warner Brothers, which had shut down its animation division in 1969, reopened that studio to assemble Looney Tunes compilations in 1980. In 1986, they poached Tom Rugger and most of his staff from the Hanna-Barbera show A Pup Named Scooby-Doo in order to restart their TV animation. Warner Brothers president Terry Semel had noticed the success of Muppet Babies and felt that a knockoff of the Looney Tunes characters would be a safe bet.
That is not at all the same energy as Muppet Babies, but carry on.
Following a fruitful partnership with Don Bluth on The Secret of Nim and An American Tale, Steven Spielberg became interested in producing animated shows through his Amblin TV division. He was also a big fan of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and figured that would open doors.
Good taste.
Warner Brothers was eager to partner with Spielberg on just about anything, but he rejected the Muppet Babies template. Spielberg felt that the Golden Age Looney Tunes shorts, directed by Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, and Friz Freleng, were so ubiquitous and acclaimed that no direct successor, no matter how well made, would be compared favorably to it. Spielberg wanted a concept related to the Looney Tunes, but distinct enough to feel modern and exist as its own thing. A subsequent pitch focusing on the children of the Looney Tunes was again rejected.
I feel like this is gonna sound very obvious as I'm saying it, but Spielberg understands this shit, huh?
Rugger is usually cited as the principal architect of what Tiny Toons became, a school where young cartoon characters learn how to be funny. The classic Looney Tunes cast occasionally appear as faculty members of Acme Luniversity, but the focus is largely on the next generation, with the school not factoring into every or even most of the show's actual content. In retrospect, Tiny Toons is an early example of the Lego sequel, a reboot that starts a franchise over with fresh faces and new stakes, but leaves room for the old characters to show up in supporting roles where they often pass the torch. When done well, the Lego sequel provides a jumping-on point for new fans without alienating the existing fan base.
Sounds like a fun, like, tightrope to walk.
We're in an age with lots of Lego sequels, the Creed movies, the J.J. Abrams, Star Trek and Star Wars films, the last two Ghostbusters. Some of them work and some of them don't. Warner Brothers dumped $25 million on the first season of Tiny Toons, a big number for a syndicated TV cartoon. While it was initially seen as an individual film in its early stages, Spielberg pushed for TV show, and it premiered in 1990. The $25 million was a good investment. The show won 7 Emmys, and it outperformed the Disney Afternoon in the ratings, which must have felt very satisfying. It also moved a truckload of merchandise, which is where the real money gets made.
I do fondly remember my Tiny Toons dolls.
And the video game for the NES. Surprisingly good platformer.
Mm. Oh god, and they had really good Happy Meal tie-in toys.
How I Spent My Vacation was greenlit in between season 2 and the final third season of the show. There was an exodus of talent during this period, as Warner Brothers Animation began developing DC superhero characters for television, and Tiny Toons creators Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, Arlene Sorkin, and others began getting involved in that.
Yay!
Worked out well for them, I think.
For many, Summer Vacation was the last hurrah before they switched from Plucky Duck to Batman. Like with Tiny Toons itself, Summer Vacation was briefly considered for a theatrical release. Spielberg vetoed this, claiming that home video was an ideal venue for animated features. His involvement with Don Bluth taught him that kids pester their parents to buy a tape of Fievel Goes West or The Little Mermaid when they're at the grocery store, and then they watch it over and over and over and over again.
Yes, we did.
Yep.
Spielberg felt that direct-to-video Tiny Toons would help build brand recognition and loyalty amongst a young and impressionable audience, and boy, did he figure us out.
Here we are today.
As I mentioned while we were watching this, several points of this movie, the dialogue just randomly comes in my brain at the most random times. Like, I'll be taking a shower, making coffee, getting ready for work, and I'll have the part where Babs is singing the Italian dishes at Buster while they're floating down the river.
Veal Parmigiana.
You haven't eaten in weeks. It's all still ground in there because of how often we watched this. All
right, this is a spicy take, but Steven Spielberg has well-honed commercial instincts.
I think he might.
He might not be the greatest filmmaker of all time, but he's the most attuned to what the popular audience demands.
Yeah, I think he might be pretty good at this job.
The direct supervisor for this and most other Tiny Toon stuff was Gene McCurdy, who ran Warner Brothers Animated Division from 1989 to 2001. Tiny Toons was their first Warner Brothers project, and the last thing she did before retiring was the Justice League cartoon.
Yay!
That was a hell of a run. McCurdy pushed for a VHS release coinciding with school vacations in April. Since kids would have a lot of free time then, that was always a bountiful sales and rental period for home video. She especially wanted it for Tiny Toons since Easter fell into April vacation in 1992, and she felt that Buster and Babs Bunny would come off as seasonally appropriate for parents shopping for Easter baskets and chocolate eggs.
That's very smart.
our childhoods were so calculated against us. We were such good customers.
Oh, soft touch. Such marks. McCurdy, when doing promotional interviews, did not specify what the budget was for Summer Vacation, but she did say that it far exceeded the typical price tag for a Tiny Toons episode, which was about $350,000. She added that a conscious creative decision was made to focus on the boredom and tedium of seemingly endless summer vacation days, especially when it came to tedious family car trips. Everyone on the staff felt that that was just like a gold mine for jokes.
They weren't wrong.
The writing team for Summer Vacation was composed of seasoned Tiny Toons writers who had composed dozens of episodes at this point, or dozens of segments. Tom Rugger himself, Nicholas Hollander, Paul Dini, and Sherry Stoner. Rugger was involved in Batman the Animated Series in a supervising and administrative capacity, but he's best known for his projects continuing in the vein of Tiny Toons. He was the principal creator of Animaniacs, Pinky and the Brain, Hysteria, and he was a supervisor on Freakazoid.
I mean, all of that is delightful too, so...
Sherry Stoner was a reference model for both Ariel and the Little Mermaid and Belle for Beauty and the Beast for Disney. After Tiny Toons wrapped up, she followed Rugger to writing for Animaniacs and also did some voice acting. Most famously, she was Slappy Squirrel.
Oh my gosh! I love her!
Yeah, everyone loves Slappy Squirrel. Summer Vacation was directed by Rich Ahrens, Ken Boyer, Kent Butterworth, Barry Caldwell, Alfred Gimeno, Art Leonardi, and Byron Vaughns. None of those guys have Wikipedia pages, but they have IMDb pages, and most of them are just seasoned animation lifers. They pop up in the credits from everything from He-Man to She-Ra to Batman vs. the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to The Lion King to The Venture Brothers to SpongeBob SquarePants.
So, like, they're just, yeah, they're big names.
Well, they're not big names, but they keep getting work.
They're big names to us.
Tokyo Movie Shinsha, who animated Akira, owned the rights to Lupin the Third, and we talked about them previously on the Little Nemo episode, produced the animation for this.
It's so much better than it needs to be.
Yeah, this is really good.
Yeah, we
really
would have watched it without, like if it had X-Men the Animated Series quality, we would have been fine.
They animated the bunnies moving their individual toes a lot, and they did not need to do that.
Or the sequence when the water droplet slowly goes down the bubbler, and then its viewpoint is mirrored back on Plucky.
Right, doing like the fish, what is it, the fisheye view or whatever?
Yeah.
Oh my god, it's so beautiful. The water, just all of the water.
And it's just the way the character postures were. One thing that stuck in my mind is, you know, Buster saying that he was in the mood, and Babs said suggestively, "For what?" And she wraps her ears around his neck very caressingly. That's well done.
Yeah, there was a lot of acting in this animation.
The songs for the film were composed by Bruce Broughton, who mostly did westerns until The Rescuers Down Under got his foot in the door for cartoons. Although he also did the incidental music for 52 episodes of Dallas. He also wrote the theme song for The Orville. Like a lot of composers, his resume is random as hell. Waiting for the Clock to Strike 3 is set to Spring Song, a piece written by the 19th century German singer, director, and all-around dandy Albert Ehrenreich. Incidental music was provided by Stephen Bramson, Don Davis, Stephen James Taylor, Mark Waters, and, of course, Richard Stone. I don't know if I need to tell you who Richard Stone is.
You do. I don't know who Richard Stone is.
Stone is often seen as the Carl Stalling of the 90s, writing many of the songs and scores for Tiny Toons, Animaniacs, Tasmania, Pinky and the Brain, Freakazoid, and Sylvester and Tweety Mysteries. Pretty much all of the title themes for those shows were composed by Rugger, Stone, or both. Cast and crew started referring to him as the Great Stonini.
That's cute.
I saw a list of something that somebody compiled of the greatest cartoon musical composers of all time, and Carl Stalling was at the top of the list because of course he was.
Of course he was, yeah.
But Stone was on there as well. He was behind Howard Ashman, but he was ahead of Shirley Walker.
I'll allow it.
All right, let's talk about the cast for a bit. A lot of names that we've talked about in prior episodes of this podcast, believe it or not.
Yeah, so I was amused to see that, like, in the credits, they did, you know, have all the cast members mentioned, but they obviously only put one character per voice actor, even though most of them, if you go to their IMDb, they have way more than one character. Funny enough, though, Charlie Adler, who is often acting with himself in cartoons, he is only Buster Bunny and Usher. He doesn't have, like, 50 credits on this.
He does have a very distinct voice, whether he's Buster Bunny or Ickis or Spike the Dragon or whoever else. You can usually tell it's him.
Yeah, but like his Gem and the Holograms characters sound different from each other.
And frankly, just because of pop culture saturation, if nothing else, I'm always happy to hear that voice.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, Buster Bunny is a sneaky little shit. That's a good voice for that.
I hated Buster Bunny as a kid, which is so fucking weird because I loved Ickis.
Well, Ickis is like a nervous guy who wants to learn to be scary. Buster doesn't need to learn to be scary. Buster
He's already an asshole.
Right? He needs to learn to sit the fuck down.
Yeah, splitting Bugs Bunny into two characters and having one of them be just his asshole side was certainly a choice.
Yeah, and it did cause lots of millennials later on to say that this is part of the reason why Bugs Bunny is definitely gender fluid.
Oh, I mean, I don't know, I just, like, Babs is just better. That's where my brain is, so I'm like, oh, okay, I can move on from there.
I mean, I think all of, like, the 40s and 50s are also ammunition for why Bugs Bunny is gender fluid and trans.
For the Tiny Toons, all of the younger opposite numbers, you get one. You get Plucky Duck, you get Hampton, you just get one. But Bugs is two people, and one's a boy and one's a girl.
Babs is so much better.
I'm sure that was just a way to market to us, though.
Oh, I do not think that was a conscious decision, no.
The 90s, I'm not saying we that. We need a pink version and a blue version, and then we can sell twice as many toys, yeah.
Yeah, and there was that episode where they really stretched to connect Babs Bunny to Honey.
That can be its a whole other episode.
Yeah, that's another can of worms we shouldn't be opening. But anyways, Trey McNeil is Babs Bunny. And most of the female celebrity impressions in this, including Roseanne Barr, they do a little gag about her infamous version of the national anthem.
Yeah, she's Babs Bunny, Big Boo, Babs' mother, Mrs. Duff, Roseanne, Barbara Walters, Chef, and then additional voices, so we know that's a lot of other small parts.
Yeah, every time you do a small part, you get an additional check, and yeah, Trey McNeil probably does the most. She probably does the most acting of anybody in this, just through the number of, like, character impressions she does.
Although, keep in mind, Frank Welker is probably every single animal.
Yeah, Frank Welker is
every single non-anthropomorphized animal.
Yeah. And the whole bit where Babs is doing the fireworks demonstration, and she's like, I enjoyed watching you sweat.
That was so good.
That was somehow more satisfying now. Gail Matthews is Shirley the Loon, doing a very typical for the early 90s time Valley Girl accent.
She was also Sissy Boo.
Besides...
Those are the alligators, the boos.
Yeah, besides her voice acting, she's best known as being a cast member for Saturday Night Live in 1980. This is often seen as the worst season in SNL history, which is a bold claim to make, but 1980 is definitely a contender. She worked the Weekend Update desk next to Charles Rocket. So yeah, Shirley the Loon. We have Kath Soucie as Fifi LaFoom, and she is probably best known for as voicing Phil and Lil on Rugrats.
Well, yay for Phil and Lil. She did fine as a skunk.
She was also Little Boo, Little Sneezer, Bimbet Skunk, and I definitely heard her as, like, smaller characters throughout, too. But yeah, no, she's pretty omnipresent for 90s animation. Always does fine work. I like her.
And frankly, if you're going to do, like, a younger 90s version of Pepe Le Pew, having it be a lovelorn female skunk is probably...
The safest, wisest choice?
Yes. They knew what they were doing. This was a very calculated chance they took. All right, we have Don Messick as Hampton. Hampton is maybe, like, the 7th or 8th most famous character that Don Messick voiced. He was the most seasoned voice actor on Tiny Toons. Generally speaking, we think of him primarily as Scooby-Doo, Papa Smurf, Muttley from Wacky Races fame, whole bunch of others. He's a Hanna-Barbera guy. Generally considered a legendary voice actor, but we're not
Hanna-Barbera people.
Yeah, we're not a Hanna-Barbera household. I do think that A Pup Named Scooby-Doo is really good. I'm not surprised that the guy in charge of A Pup Named Scooby-Doo later defected to Warner Brothers and did a bunch of cartoons I actually like a whole lot more than all of Hanna-Barbera's output.
Says he was also the radio announcer, which is a wonderful bit. The radio announcer announces the escaped lunatic in the car.
Excellent work. Too bad that Messick spent most of his career at a studio that we don't like. All right, we have Joe Alasky as Plucky Duck.
He is also Tupelo Toad, Johnny Carson, David Letterman. Oh, he did the sad Elmer Fudd. And then additional voices, so imagine various other characters.
Yeah, when Fifi's trying to get to the handsome teen heartthrob skunk, she blunders onto the set of a talk show that is like every 90s talk show host running their show at the exact same time. David Letterman's there, Oprah's there, Barbara Walters is there, Arsenio Hall.
It's a nice way, I feel like, for them to take, like, all of those old Looney Tunes cartoons that would just do caricatures of Golden Age Hollywood and do, like, a 90s riff on that. I thought it was pretty boring when I was a kid, and I didn't really fully understand all of the references. It also set me up to be very disappointed in the size of Jay Leno's chin.
I mean, it's prominent, but it's not to the point where he needs a dolly.
Yeah, no, it's just a big chin. It's not even a huge chin.
Alasky was one of the many actors that Warner Brothers brought in as a successor to Mel Blanc. He spent the majority of his career voicing Looney Tunes cast members until he passed away in 2016. As Sylvan pointed out, he did the not that great, the 70% there Elmer Fudd that is briefly on the radio. But besides that, he was Grandpa Pickles on Rugrats. His Plucky performance in this is magnificent.
Yes.
Plucky is on an emotional roller coaster throughout this, especially since he doesn't get to ride a real roller coaster.
Oh, burn.
All right, here's a name we've heard before. Maurice LaMarche as Dizzy Devil. Very tiny, incidental character. LaMarche got a lot more to do on Animaniacs, to put it mildly.
Yeah, he also did some more of the celebrity impressions.
Yeah, he does a lot of celebrity...
Oh, and he's the audience is now deaf.
Ah, he has a very stentorian deep voice, and among his many celebrity impressions is Orson Welles. That led to later work.
Yay!
Although you might also know him as Kiff on Futurama.
Also yay!
We have Frank Welker, because of course we do. He was Furball, Byron, Go-Go Dodo, Little Beeper, and he was Uncle Stinky, and every other animal noise.
Yeah, you can hear him all over that wild safari park.
I mean, every time Frank Welker comes up and he's like, what else am I going to say about Frank Welker?
I mean, if you're interested in animation and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are. It's really fun, but time consuming to go through his IMDb credits.
Yeah, it's miles long, even by voice acting standards, and he's still working. It's not stopping. Speaking of names that pop up a lot, although not quite as much, Rob Paulsen. He is Banjo Possum and Foulmouth. He would also become more prominent on Animaniacs.
He's also Johnny Pugh, Horatio, Mr. Hitcher, manager, parking attendant, and additional voices.
Johnny Pugh is essentially Smug Pinky.
Yeah, I can get that, yeah.
All right, getting on to more voices that just keep coming. Cree Summer was Elmira Duff, and I believe she was Oprah.
Yep, and also Mary Melody, which is the box look thing.
Yeah, Summer, she basically has
a voice acting legend, yeah.
Yeah, and she's another Charlie Adler. You can usually tell it's her. She started out as a child, voicing Penny on Inspector Gadget, and then she just kept going. Then we have Candy Milo. She was Sweetie Pie, who had a very minor part in this. Her resume is mostly minor incidental characters all throughout the 90s. The biggest role I found for her is that she was Dexter on season 3 and 4 in Dexter's Laboratory. She replaced Christine Cavanaugh when she suddenly retired in 2000. For the release and reception of this, the video was a resounding success, charting on bestseller lists for 41 consecutive weeks. This convinced Warner Brothers to begin releasing VHS copies of Tiny Toons episodes, because they hadn't done that up to this point. The film was broken up into quadrants and then added to syndication packages of Tiny Toons as 4 additional episodes just to pad things out to over 60 episodes, make it more attractive to syndication. Tiny Toons is one of the few shows that aired on both Nickelodeon and the Cartoon Network.
Well, that explains why we saw it.
Reviews were mostly positive, although there were a few clueless writers in the early 90s wondering why the humor in this was a lot more violent and snarky and filmed with more gross-out vomit jokes than Disney fare. It's like they didn't understand the history of the Looney Tunes or something. One critic seemed baffled at the very concept of Tiny Toons. He wondered why that there were younger cartoon characters who were being mentored by off-screen Looney Tunes. And he didn't know why they existed in the Looney Tunes reality, and why it wasn't about the Looney Tunes. This review was hilarious to read.
You didn't think to get any excerpts or anything?
I don't know.
We can always Google that.
But anyways, that brings us to themes. And I just wrote down one, but it's long. The concept of comedy itself.
That is a big theme. I'm ready to hear this.
Well, it made me think of a retrospective magazine I had that covered all of Bruce Timm's career, and he talked about every facet of it, including his work on Tiny Toons. He wasn't happy during his period there. Bruce Timm felt that he wasn't as funny as Paul Dini, Arlene Sorkin, or any of his other pals, you know, because he was more of a sci-fi fantasy and superhero nerd, and he was much more comfortable on Batman. He also wasn't crazy about Spielberg's meddling. Despite Tiny Toons actually having a lampshade gag about Spielberg doing absolutely nothing except slapping his name on the project, Spielberg was actually very closely involved in the show. Infamously, Spielberg read a fan letter from some kids who suggested a Tiny Toons plot, and he wound up inviting them to the studio to turn their idea into an episode. This inspired Bart and Lisa to do the same thing for Itchy and Scratchy on a Simpsons episode.
That's really cute!
Tim felt that Spielberg hobbled the show's ability to emulate the wilder elements of the classic Looney Tunes shorts. As Tim put it, Spielberg had just directed The Color Purple, and he was going through a sentimentalist period in his creative life. This apparently made him more likely to shoot down any Tex Avery-styled ideas that got a little more ribald. Spielberg was remarkably staid. For example, he always stifled people from engaging in on-set hookups on the sets of his movies. Infamously, he married the leading lady in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and even though they were kind of flirty with each other, he didn't do anything until they met, like, years later. He was like, I have to be a professional, I am directing this person, I am their supervisor, I am their employer, it would be inappropriate for me to make gestures.
A decent human being that understands power imbalances.
But he was also that's kind of gross. Let's not do that to Bruce Timm all the time. And it drove him nuts because he's like, it's Looney Tunes.
Yeah, but I'm fine with that. I didn't like Tex Avery.
No, I'm cool with that too.
And also, apparently, this wasn't an issue on Animaniacs with their Hello Nurse and Goodnight Everybody.
But I didn't like those parts.
Fair enough. Also, that fingerprints joke that apparently got by Spielberg, and also network censors.
I mean, that one made me giggle. That one I'm fine with.
The Tim and Rugger factions of Warner Brothers TV Animation attempted to reunite for Freakazoid. The concept originated with Tim and was pitched as a grounded coming-of-age superhero dramedy in the style of Spider-Man.
What?
Yeah, Spielberg was...
They wandered away from that, yes.
Spielberg was lukewarm about this concept until Rugger began adding wacky stuff like Candlejack and Hugbees and self-aware gags about merchandising and product placement. Tim soured on the project, essentially turned it over to Rugger and stepped away. He publicly claims that he was glad that his team got 2 years and change of work out of Freakazoid, but you can kind of tell that he's still upset about it even now.
It's a very different show from that concept.
Yeah, I identify Freakazoid more with the Rugger than with Tim. I put that next to Pinky and the Brain in Hysteria.
Oh, 100%. Candlejack absolutely could just be part of Animaniacs.
I mean, what constitutes funny is something that's pondered over in the stated text of Tiny Toons and most of its spiritual successors. The characters are literally studying what comedy is, and also in a very metatextual way, why the Looney Tunes are as loved as they are. In some ways, Tiny Toons is a study in why people like the Looney Tunes to begin with, I'd say. I think part of the reason lies in that the Looney Tunes were just available. Jack Warner hated television, he thought it was a fad, and he had no idea that the Looney Tunes were valuable, so he basically gave away the TV syndication rights for the shorts for the equivalent of pocket change. They were cheap to broadcast for decades, almost 50 years, so they were fucking everywhere. For instance, the whole Looney Tunes wearing hip-hop clothing trend of the 90s, which started out as unlicensed bootlegs and then officially became merchandise, came into being because, at least partially, old Looney Tunes shorts were a common programming block filler on regional TV stations in densely populated urban communities. For a lot of people who only had three TV channels, at least two of them were always playing Looney Tunes shorts. Aristotle theorized that all humor is founded in ridicule. According to him, humans find mirth in attacking their enemies and bullying their inferiors. We take pleasure in the suffering of others, in other words. Conservatives love this idea, and I often hear it from edgelord internet trolls. It is, of course, bullshit. People laugh at puns, knock-knock jokes, wholesome memes, and lots of other types of humor that doesn't specifically attack anyone. As we've discussed on this podcast before, Aristotle is wrong about pretty much everything. Still, assault and deprecation makes up a lot of humor, maybe even most of it in some historical eras. And the Looney Tunes distinguished themselves from Disney by being a bit more manic, rude, and vaudevillian than the respectable Mouse House could ever be. Bugs wasn't programmed to be an anti-Mickey, but it's not outlandish to suspect that he was. Bugs is sarcastic when Mickey is sweet. Bugs is a New Yorker when Mickey is very much from small-town America. Bugs will obliterate an opera singer who incurs his anger while Mickey would never do such a thing.
At least post-Steamboat Willie Mickey.
That was the very next line I wrote down. I was like, I gotta get there before Sylvan beats me to it.
Haha.
Too bad.
Yeah, early Mickey Mouse is a shit.
And the thing is,
and he will date rape Minnie up in that fucking plane.
The thing is, it takes almost no time at all for Mickey to not do that anymore. Like, less than a year. Warner Brothers has a long history of not understanding the Looney Tunes. This benefited the original artists of Termite Terrace in that they were allowed to make anything they wanted as long as it came in on time and on budget, but it hurt them when it came to many other executive decisions. Jack Warner, for instance, foolishly assumed that the animated shorts division was expendable when he wanted to throw every bit of spare capital that Warner Brothers had into making 3D movies. He thought that that was going to be the thing that lured audiences back into theaters during the television age. That didn't work out for him, and then he had to beg Chuck Jones and Friz Freleng and everyone else to come back.
Haha.
Yeah, I do like hearing stories about him suffering.
And that continued onwards. For instance, when Warner Brothers started up their TV division, Paul Dini wanted to refer to the building that everyone worked out of as Termite Tower, and all the executives were like, why would you want to call it that?
What?
Paul Dini is still a bit salty that it didn't catch on.
It's okay, Paul, we'll call it that.
Post-Golden Age Looney Tunes has a really spotty record. Sylvan would think that the word spotty is me being generous here.
Yeah.
Tiny Toons and Animaniacs is arguably the closest Warner Brothers ever got to recapturing what made those cartoons work to begin with. I don't think that's an especially bold statement.
No, I mean, you can tell they were made by people who were real big fans.
So what is that? Why is that? Why does Tiny Toons work when, say, Space Jam doesn't? Fuck you, Space Jam doesn't work.
Wait, which Space Jam are we talking about? Because I love the Space Jam movie, the first one.
I am referring to both Space Jams.
Well, it's okay to be wrong.
Alright. I think Tiny Toons and Animaniacs both put the focus on slapstick and physical humor. There are constant pop culture and movie references. Humor is aimed at both kids and the parents. Sometimes most of the parents. We've gone over that already. There's also a pretty short duration for all of these. I think the people working on Tiny Toons and Animaniacs understand that these types of characters work best as short film subjects. You know, 5 to 7 minutes in length. Even this, How I Spent My Summer Vacation, it's
carved up into segments.
Yeah, it's a series of loosely interconnected vignettes that are largely put together through match cuts and random background cameos. Like when Fifi and Foulmouth are watching the movie, Babs and Buster are screaming for help in the background in one of the ads.
That's still good.
Yeah, I think one reason why these work so well is because they do try to take, like, the essence of the, you know, golden age theatrical shorts, but they thought carefully about how to make them appropriate for the 90s and make them work in the 90s. You can't do riff for riff the same beats because the original Looney Tunes are very much of their day and age. So adapt that to, you know, the 40 or so years later. And they're very successful in that.
Yeah, and occasionally there's like an old school reference, like Babs does the Lucille Ball impression in this, but, you know, she also does Cher. And yeah, it's a hard needle to thread because a lot of the same people also worked on, say, Tasmanian, Sylvester and Tweety Mysteries, both shows which I think don't work quite as well.
Tasmania had a wonderful theme song, though.
I genuinely forgot about both of those things until we started doing this episode. I'm like, oh, yeah!
I know I liked Tasmania, but I have also not seen that since the 90s, and I doubt I would feel like it worked as well as this movie did.
Yeah, it doesn't. One of the characters is a Woody Allen impression, and that has aged even worse than you think it has. Anyways, that's everything I wrote down about this. Is there anything that either of you would like to comment about Tiny Toons before we close things out?
So for going back and watching something from the 90s that is, again, very much of its day, this was super watchable. There was no, that I noticed, casual racism, homophobia, transphobia. It wasn't sexist, despite the fact that there was like a teenage girl having a stupid crush storyline. Like, I was so pleasantly surprised. It's not mean-spirited. And a lot of 90s shows, you're just watching and enjoying yourself, and then suddenly there's a gay joke or something, and this was nice. I could watch this with a child now and be okay and comfortable and not have to be like, oh, we're gonna have to have a nuanced discussion about a serious social issue after this.
Yeah, it turns out like Tom Ruger, Paul Dini, Sherry Stoner, pretty cool people.
Yeah.
And also just on a technical level, well accomplished. Like, the timing was good, the voice acting was skewed to the gags very well, animation was excellent, even by the standard of its time, even by modern times, really.
Alright, I have a question for both of you guys. Just because for me it didn't change, but I'm very curious about you two. When you were younger, you clearly had a favorite Tiny Toons character. Did that change now watching this movie as an adult?
You know what, I used to really like Furball, I just felt bad for him, and I liked playing as him in the NES platformer, but yeah, based on this movie, I'm on Team Plucky now.
I honestly never really did have an absolute favorite. I would kind of jump around based on whoever was highlighted best in the episode that we watched most recently. I went back to Babs a lot because I had a Babs doll that I liked. And, you know, she was pink and wore a purple skirt, and those are both important points to me. But I think it might be Babs again. I really liked her bit rescuing Buster from the Croc family and resonated with the water gun fight.
Okay, cool. I was just curious.
What about you?
Oh, I mean, so as a kid, it was always a tie between Dodo and Babs. And I still love Babs. She did Tina Turner. Like, come on.
I do appreciate Babs a lot more now than I did as a kid.
I appreciate Elmira more than I did as a kid, too. I felt bad, so bad, for all the animals that she tortured that I didn't really find her funny, and now I'm just like, ah, that's me. Furball's my cat.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time.